This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Barbra Streisand has just released a new album, a double CD set of songs with lyrics by today's guests, Alan and Marilyn Bergman. One disc collects Bergman songs Streisand has released in the past, including The Way We Were, What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life, You Don't Bring Me Flowers, and songs from Yentl. The other disc is of new recordings of their compositions, including this one, Nice and Easy.
Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy for us to fall in love. Hey, baby, what's your hurry? Relax, don't you worry. We're gonna fall in love. We're on the road to Rome. But let's make all the stops along the way. The problem now, of course, is to simply hold your horses. To rush would be
The Bergmans are married and have collaborated on songs for over 50 years. Terry spoke with them in 2007. The songs of Alan and Marilyn Bergman have won Oscars, Golden Globes, and Grammys, and have been covered not only by Barbra Streisand, but by Tony Bennett and Frank Sinatra. Sinatra recorded his version of Nice and Easy in 1960 and liked it enough to feature it as the title track of his album.
The problem now, of course, is to simply hold your horses. To rush would be a crime. 'Cause nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it every time. Like the man says one more time. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it every time.
Marilyn and Alan Bergman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much.
How did you come up with the phrase Nice and Easy, which became the title of the song and Sinatra's album?
Yeah, well, when you write for somebody like Frank Sinatra, who has a definite personality, you try to write, it's easy to write a custom-made suit for him. You know, he's very theatrical. He has a definite character. And we felt, because they wanted something that was easy swinging, that nice and easy, the phrase, the nice and easy does it every time, would be good for him.
It also had a kind of subtext of to be a little sexy, which certainly also was part of Sinatra.
Is this one of those many songs about sex that isn't literally about sex, but it's absolutely about sex?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So when Sinatra says on his version of the record toward the end, like the man said, which isn't in the lyric. did it bother you? Or did you think, hey?
Oh, not at all. No, not at all.
And in fact, he had we we were lucky enough to be there at Capitol Records when he did record this, and he had several different endings.
Oh.
He would ad-lib something each time they got to the tag line, and this is the one that they decided to use.
Did Sinatra ever ask you to write for him after having such success with this song?
Yes. Yes, he did several times. There was one time we received a call from him and said, I want you to write me a 10-minute number. And we said, about what? He said, well, you know, boy meets girl, boy gets girl, boy loses girl, and so on. And we said to him, well, that's really been written. He said, you'll figure it out. He used to call us the kids. And he said, you kids, you'll figure it out. And he said, get the frog, which means get Michel Legrand to be the composer. And Michel's father was very sick at the time, and Michel couldn't do it. So we called him and said, is John Williams okay? It was Johnny Williams. He was not the well-known conductor-composer then. And we said, John, would you like to do this? And he said, yeah, let's do it.
So we wrote a 10-minute piece, which incidentally he wanted for his nightclub act. So we wrote a piece that talked about the fact that the protagonist of the piece, in this case the singer, fell in love with the same woman over and over and over. I don't mean literally the same woman, but, you know, the same woman. And each love affair ended badly. And I think I remember the phrase, the same hello, the same goodbye. And when we finished it, we called him and told him that we had finished it, and he asked us if we would come down to Palm Springs, where he had a home, and play it for him. So the three of us drove down to Palm Springs, and we got to house, but more like a compound, actually. And he opened the door himself when we finally made our way to the house. And Alan sang the song for him. Alan, what was that experience? You tell it.
Well, he was sitting on an ottoman in front of me, and I sang for 10 minutes. You know, that's a long time.
You were not sitting on an ottoman Theater in Brooklyn.
No.
You heard him as a kid.
That's right. When I was finished, he was crying. And he said to Marilyn, how do you know so much about me? As if his life was such...
Such a
closed book, you know. But it must have hit some nerve. And he said, I have to learn this. This is terrific. I love it. And but he never learned it.
And every time we would see him, he would say, I'm going to do that.
I'm going to do that. Don't, you know.
But he never did. It was a very nice experience, I must say.
Yeah.
Well, Alan Bergman, you've released this new album, Lyrically, of songs that you wrote with your wife, Marilyn. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to make an album of you singing your songs? I think it's the first time you've done that.
Yes, this is the first time. It's not exactly that I wanted. You know, we did a concert there. There's a series in New York in the 92nd Street Y called Lyrics and Lyricists. Mm-hmm. And we did that. There was a 25th anniversary, and they asked us to do it again for them, and we did. And a man came up to me after the concert, and from Germany, and he said, I have a record company in Germany, and I think you're a great singer. I want to make an album with you. And I said, I'm not so sure. And he kept after me for 2 or 3 years. And finally I said, okay, I'll do it. And he flew Marilyn and I to Berlin, and he organized a big orchestra and a young arranger who did a wonderful job. Jorg Keller, his name is. And I sang live with this orchestra, which was a wonderful experience. I had a wonderful time. I love to sing, so...
Ellen has always sung, actually. When we write, we sing as we write, because lyrics, unlike poetry, are meant to be sung. So he's always sung, and most of the time it's Alan who would demonstrate the song for the artist or the producer, director, whoever was on the receiving end of the song.
Can you diagnose problems in the lyric by singing it?
Oh yes, oh yes. You know, sometimes the choice of a word, you try that word and it may be the perfect word, but it doesn't sing on those notes.
Can you give me an example of a lyric you changed because singing it you knew it didn't work?
Mm. I can't give you a lyric of ours. It's an interesting question, but Oscar Hammerstein, probably one of the greatest lyric writers, always felt that a song that he and Richard Rodgers wrote for Oklahoma, a wonderful song called What's the Use of Wondering, never found its way into the repertoire of singers as much as some of the other songs in that show did, because the last line is, and all the rest is talk. And ending a song on the word talk, which you can hear cuts off on that hard K sound, didn't allow a singer to really
sing it beautifully at the end. You know, there's no, and all the rest is talk. I mean, it's so difficult, and that's why it's not part of the repertoire.
Let's listen to Alan Bergman sing from his album Lyrically. This is What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life, which was written for the 1969 film The Happy Ending. The composer was Michel Legrand. Why don't you tell us the story behind the song before we hear it?
Richard Brooks, who was a wonderful writer and director, directed and wrote this film called The Happy Ending, which I think was well ahead of its time and occasionally will appear on very, very late night television, but really didn't find an audience. Anyway, he came to us one day and said, I want you to write me a song that is to appear twice in the film. Early in the film, I want it to function as perhaps a proposal of marriage between these two young lovers. But I want to hear the song again at the end of the film, at which time the wife, they were since married, 16 years later, the wife has become alcoholic and has left her husband and is in a bar and goes to a jukebox and selects a song and then sits down with a lineup of martinis in front of her. And he's shot this beautiful montage of Gene Simmons, who played the wife, during which time she drifts into kind of a reverie while listening to the same song. And he said, I don't want you to change a note or a word, but I want the song to mean something very different when you hear it the second time. So that was a very interesting, challenging assignment. And Michel Legrand wrote perhaps, I don't know, 6 or 8 tunes as his wont and for this spot. And they were all beautiful, but none really struck the three of us as being right. And we said to him, because while he was writing music, we were sitting trying to solve the dramatic question of what the song should be about. We said to him, what happens if the first line of the song is, what do you do in the rest of your life? And he said, oh, I like that. And he put his hands on the keys. And as long as it takes to play that song, that's what he played from beginning to end. And he said, you mean something like that? And we said, no, we mean exactly like that. And Alan said to him, play it again. And he said, oh, I don't remember quite what I played. Luckily, we had the tape machine going. So we had the music.
So the first line of the song inspired the melody.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
But that happens sometimes. With Michelle, we can't write lyrics first. We prefer not to write lyrics first. We prefer to have the melody. We feel that when we have the melody, that there are words on the tips of those notes, and we have to find them.
Well, let's hear Alan Bergman singing What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life from his new album Lyrically, featuring songs with lyrics that he and Marilyn Bergman co-wrote.
What are you doing the rest of your life? North and south and east and west of your life. I have only one request of your life, that you spend it all with me. All the seasons and the times of your days, all the nickels and the dimes of your days, let the reasons and the rhymes of your days all begin and end with me. I want to see your face in every kind of light, in fields of dawn and forests of the night. And when you stand before the candles on a cake, oh, let me be the one to hear the silent wish you make. Those tomorrows waiting deep in your eyes.
That's Alan Bergman from his album Lyrically, which features him singing songs that he co-wrote with Marilyn Bergman. They're married and longtime lyricist collaborators. Now that song was recently used on a commercial for diamonds. So did you have to give your permission for that?
This is odd. When you write for hire, as we did, What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life? We were hired by the studio to write it. They own the copyright. And they can ask you. They don't have to ask for permission. Most of the time, when they're not changing a word of the lyric, they really don't bother. When there's a change in the lyric, then they do. Then they notify you and ask you if
this
it's...
This was using the Dusty Springfield record of the song. So nothing was changed, and it was a record that had been, you know, it is out, and so I guess they felt there was no need to ask us.
So when you say that the studio owns the copyright, you still get composer credits, right?
Composer
royalties.
We get credit and we get royalties.
Credits and royalties, but they, in fact, they, meaning the publishing company arm of the studio, owns the rights to the song.
Now, you've written a lot of songs, or a fair number of songs, for movies. Some of your best-known songs are songs you wrote for movies. You haven't written that much for theater. How did you gravitate to writing songs for movies?
I think maybe movies made a deeper impression growing up. And we always knew that we wanted to write in a dramatic context. We were more interested in that than we were in just writing songs in limbo. Writing for in a narrative or dramatic context, when we were honing craft, you can't write for a picture unless somebody hires you, you know? So it's like an actor not being able to act unless he gets a job or she gets a job. So we would do exercises. We would find either short stories or scenes from plays or articles in the newspaper and pretend that they were assignments. And we wrote many, many, many songs that never saw the light of day but were exercises that we gave ourselves. So I like to think that when the first job came, we were ready.
Marilyn and Alan Bergman speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. We'll continue their conversation in the second half of the show. Here's Abby Lincoln singing one of their songs, Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
wishes, winter dreams, drifting down forgotten streams, songs and faces, smiles and whispers.
You were both writing lyrics for the composer Lou Spence, who wrote the melody for Nice and Easy, which was one of your first hits. And Marilyn, the way you described it, one of you was his morning lyricist and the other was his afternoon lyricist. Mm-hmm. How did he end up having two different lyricists?
Because I like to sleep late.
It was early in our careers, and you know, we were trying to find out who we are, what we're saying, and he was writing.
He was talented.
Yeah,
I did it too.
But did you know each? He introduced you. Did you know each other yet when you were both writing lyrics separately?
No. I was introduced to him by Bob Russell, a wonderful lyric writer who was a mentor of mine, who, when I started to write, introduced me to this composer. And Alan must have met him around in the music business in L.A. But they were not teams of writers so much then. You know, we were all just writing songs. And we worked with him for quite a while. Yeah. And that was the most successful of the songs that we wrote together.
Okay, so you were writing, you were both independently writing lyrics for Lou Spence. You met
with Lou Spence.
Okay. You met through him, and then you decided that you should be writing lyrics with each other.
Yeah.
So
we wrote a song that day.
Yeah.
We the first day we were introduced to each other, we wrote a song. It was a terrible song, but we loved the process. We enjoyed the process, and from that day on, we've been writing together.
Can you share a few bars of the awful song?
Oh my God! Was
I only know the title.
Which was?
I never knew what hit me.
Ouch.
Something like that. Ouch is right.
Alan Bergman, one of the songs you sing on your new album, Lyrically, is a song that you say was an engagement gift to Marilyn Bergman.
Yes.
And the song is That Face, which was first recorded by Fred Astaire. So before we hear you sing it, what's the story behind this song?
Well, Lou Spence, who wrote the music, he was going out with a girl, and Marilyn and I were going out together, and wanted to ask her to marry me and have some kind of engagement. I didn't have any money, so we wrote this song, and we got an appointment with Fred Astaire. Fred Astaire was Marilyn's favorite singer. She loved the way he sang.
And still do.
Me too.
Yes. Well, you know, to digress for a second, the literature of the popular music in this country would be much poorer without a Fred Astaire, because all those great writers, Berlin, the Gershwins, Cole Porter, and so they all wrote for him. You know, Johnny Mercer. We wangled an appointment with Fred Astaire and sang him the song. He said, before I listened, he said, he owned a record company. He said, I only record what I sing in movies, but I'll listen. He's very sweet. And so we played and sang him the song, and he said, I'm going to record this next week. And he did. And I handed Marilyn this this record, I said.
And I married him.
And she married me.
Let's hear you sing it from the new Alan Bergman CD, Lyrically.
That face, that face, that wonderful face, it shines, it glows all over the place, and how I love to watch it change expressions.
becomes the prize of my possessions. I love that face, that face. It just isn't fair. You must forgive the way that I stare, but never will these eyes behold a sight that could replace that face, that face, that face. I see that face.
That's Alan Bergman from his album Lyrically, in which he sings lyrics that were co-written with his wife Marilyn Bergman, with the exception of the song we just heard. That's the only one in which he wrote the lyric himself. So Alan Bergman, Johnny Mercer was your mentor. How were you lucky enough to get to know him?
Well, I met him when I was in graduate school at UCLA, and he heard some things I had written, and he took a liking to me, and he spent, over a period of 2 or 3 years, he would call me and say, I know all you're doing is working. This is before I met Marilyn. And we would go down with his family to Newport, where he had a place, where he had a house, and we would spend the weekend. He would sit at the piano and listen to me play and sing. He liked the way I sang, and he was just terrific. I mean, I wouldn't be talking to you without him. He was just marvelous to me.
So what was some of the best advice that Johnny Mercer ever gave you about songwriting?
Ah. Well, he just outlined the craft about singing. You're writing for an instrument, and you have to respect that. And a lot about imagery. You can do better than that. It wouldn't be specific, really, which was great, because that helped. The more specific he would, I think, teachers get, the less you feel free to express yourself. Some of the early songs of mine, you can hear Johnny Mercer in them. Trying to emulate him till I found and we found our own voice.
Also, I think what we each learned from mentors that we had was that songs, probably like anything else that one writes, are not written, they're rewritten.
Yeah.
And you can't really get too passionate about any one word or one phrase. And you just have to be free enough and ruthless enough with your work to really keep writing until somebody wrests it away from you, I think.
Lyricists Marilyn and Alan Bergman speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2007 interview with Alan and Marilyn Bergman. Barbara Streisand has just released a 2-CD set of her versions of their songs called What Matters Most. Barbara Streisand sings the lyrics of Alan and Marilyn Bergman.
Marilyn, when you decided that you really wanted to become a lyricist, did you think, well, this is going to be really hard to do because there are so... First of all, it's hard to be a lyricist under the best of circumstances, but second of all, there were so few women who were lyricists at the time that you started writing. Did you think this is going to be impossible?
As a woman, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't think it was going to be impossible. I knew that I would be, the odd woman out. I would go to ASCAP meetings, membership meetings, and it would be me And a lot of the widows of songwriters who were there representing their husbands' estates, you know. So in New York, there was Betty Comden and Dorothy Fields, and there were, you know, a couple of famous women writers.
Carolyn Lee.
Yes.
Carolyn Lee, for sure. But she was about the same time. By the time I met Carolyn, I was already a professional writer, as she was, certainly. She was a wonderful writer.
Oh, absolutely. Terrific writer.
Yeah.
Marilyn, did you have a mentor in the way that Alan had a mentor in Johnny Mercer?
Yes, I did. When I was in high school in New York, I went to the High School of Music and Art. I was a music major. And I was lucky enough to become friendly with a girl named Marilyn Jackson, a very good singer, who unfortunately is no longer with us. But she introduced me to her aunt and uncle, and her uncle was a very successful songwriter, lyric writer, named Bob Russell. He wrote a lot of the Duke Ellington songs, Don't Get Around Much Anymore, Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. He wrote lyrics to Brazil and Ballerina, and a lot of songs. Very, very gifted. And I used to play the piano for him in the afternoon after school. This was the olden days before tape recorders and stuff like that. So a lyric writer who didn't play the piano used to have somebody sit and play tunes for them. And I became very interested in what he was doing, though I never dreamed that someday that's what I would do. This was just an afternoon exercise for me. And then, if you want the story, I'll give it to you quickly. I fell down a flight of steps and I broke my shoulder and dislocated the other. And so I could no longer live in New York. And I had to come out to California, where my parents had moved while I was in high school, college, I don't remember. And the only person I knew here was Bob Russell, who, with his family, had moved here in the years since my high school day. I was in college when this happened. And I came out here and in practically a body cast and looked him up, and we were visiting, and I said, what am I going to do out here for all these months? I don't know anybody, and I can't do anything. And he said, well, why don't you write songs? And I said, I can't play the piano. I can't even turn the pages in a book. He said, so write lyrics. You can dictate them into the now-invented cassette player or reel-to-reel, whatever it was. So I said, oh. And I wrote a lyric, and he introduced me to a young composer named Lou Spence. Now we've come a little circle here, right? And that's how I became Lou Spence's morning lyric writer.
Afternoon
lyric writer, forgive me. And Bob functioned very much the same way that Johnny did with Alan. Bob used to critique what I'd written, and he was a taskmaster, I'm delighted to say. And so I was, I don't think, I, there's no question that I was studying clinical psychology at NYU. Why would I write songs if I hadn't fallen down a flight of steps?
Well, I love stories about catastrophe that have happy endings. So.
That's right.
Glad to hear how it worked out. Now, you know, we've been talking about songs you've written for movies. Now, one of your famous songs that hasn't been recorded either by Tony Bennett or Frank Sinatra or Barbara Streisand is the theme for Maude. I just have to ask you about that. You know, the lyrics are Lady Godiva was a freedom rider. She didn't care if the whole world looked. Joan of Arc with the Lord to guide her. She was a sister who really cooked. Do you look back at that and think, oh, was that dated?
No, I don't know. It fit B. Arthur's character. Norman Lear asked us to write a piece for her, Norman Lear and Bud Yorkin, who were tandem productions then, asked us to write a theme song for this show.
With a wonderful composer, Dave Grusin.
Yeah. And so this is what we wrote. And it was because she was this ardent feminist creature. So that was fun.
And that's fun because, you know, you have 45 seconds to write something that will capture the audience and tell them a little bit about what they're going to see.
And don't touch that dial.
Right.
So that's how we approach it, you know. Like Good Times, same thing, you know.
What's the lyric you wish you had written? Like the lyric that to you is the lyric that all songs should be measured against.
Oh, God.
Oh, boy. We have a lot of those.
Skylark is one.
Yeah. I've grown accustomed to her face.
That's another one.
Mm-hmm. Another one.
All the Things You Are is another one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They Can't Take That Away From Me.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Too Late Now.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's...
Sending the Clouds.
Yeah.
Almost anything that Steve
Anything
Sondheim
that Sondheim writes, yes.
He's the measure right now.
Well, a pleasure to talk with you both. Let's close with another song. I thought we'd close with Where Do You Start, which it was not written for a movie.
No. That's a good way to close. It closes a relationship.
And Where Do You Start? We have, you know, in our process, we have a lot of wonderful composer friends. Dave Grusin is one, you know, besides Michelle. And Johnny Mandel is a wonderful composer. Sometimes Dave or Johnny will come over to the house and say, what do you think of this melody? And they play it, and we usually love it. We say, leave it here, you know, and we take it off the shelf and listen to them play and hopefully get an idea. There are two songs like that in the album. One is Where Do You Start? And the other is Love Like Ours, which just... they're wonderful melodies which we feel we have to write.
And they'll be in a drawer on a cassette or in a shelf, and from time to time when we're not working on something in particular, we'll take it out and play it and see if the muse is in the room. And Where Do You Start is a melody of Johnny Mandel's that we really liked, and it took us a long time before we found an idea for it that we liked. And people have told us that they were married to What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life, broke up to Where Do You Start, and were divorced to The Way We Were. So, so much for
that's
that.
Really funny. So how does it make you feel knowing that, like, you're the soundtrack in some way to the ups and downs of so many romantic relationships?
It's very humbling. It's very humbling.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, you know, that you've stayed together as a couple and as partners for so long. It's sometimes, for so many people, it's so hard to work with a spouse and to work as closely as you have to as lyricists, and to have kept a marriage up for so many years is pretty incredible.
Yeah, we've been writing together for 51 years.
Well, congratulations on not having had to sing The Way We Were in your own lives.
Oh, yeah. Hardly.
I can't imagine it any other way.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Great pleasure, Terry.
Lyricists Alan and Marilyn Bergman speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. A new Barbra Streisand collection of their songs has just been released. It's called What Matters Most. Barbra Streisand sings the lyrics of Alan and Marilyn Bergman. We'll end this segment with Alan Bergman singing their song, Where Do You Start?
Where do you start? How do you separate the present from the past? How do you deal with all the things you thought would last? That didn't last. With bits of memories scattered here and there, I look around and don't know where to start. Which books are yours?
which tapes and dreams belong to you and which are mine. Our lives are tangled like the branches of a vine that intertwine. So many habits that we'll have to break, and yesterdays we'll have to take.
The actress Vera Farmiga is now a director, too. She makes her directorial debut with the new film Higher Ground, in which she also stars, as a woman first enchanted by, then disillusioned by, evangelical Christianity. As an actress, she won acclaim as a drug-addicted mom in the 2004 drama Down to the Bone. She went on to appear in such films as The Departed and Up in the Air, for which she received an Oscar nomination. Film critic David Edelstein reviews her first effort behind the camera.
Higher Ground centers on a woman who joins and after a decade flees a fundamentalist religious order. But the tone isn't irreverent. The film is flushed with wonder, hope, and finally, heartbreak. In the memoir on which it's based, This Dark World, writer Carolyn S. Briggs never stops longing for a connection to God. And Farmiga, who also plays the protagonist, Corinne, frames the film as a kind of love story, starting the movie with Corinne opening her eyes underwater at the moment of her baptism, seeing men smiling down like heaven's welcoming committee. Corinne doesn't want to come up for air. That's when Farmiga cuts to Corinne decades earlier, also holding her breath underwater, but as a child in a bathtub, where she escapes the fighting of her flirty mom, played by Donna Murphy, and angry, alcoholic dad, played by John Hawkes. Farmiga doesn't appear again for more than half an hour, but the two girls playing Corinne in flashback are uncanny. The first, Mackenzie Turner, combines a sly intelligence and impishness with a seemingly irreconcilable craving to surrender to a higher authority, raising her hand when a choir teacher asks who's willing to pledge his or her life to Christ. As a teenager, Corinne is played by Farmiga's real-life sister, Thaisa, who has similarly sky-blue eyes and a presence that's airy but alert. A budding writer, Corinne falls hard for the high school celebrity, a dreamboat rock musician named Ethan, played by Boyd Holbrook. She gets pregnant, they marry, and become fundamentalists after an accident that almost takes the life of their baby. They join an evangelical church of scruffy folk music types, it's the 70s, who believe the Lord also, quote, writes his gospel in the rocks and trees. Coming back to the baptism scene that opened the film, Corinne sings atop a hill, long hair swaying, and the rapturous vibe is like the musical Godspell with better music. Who wouldn't think, I want what she's having? Farmiga and cinematographer Michael McDonough know how to frame the actors loosely, yet catch all the emotions that count, both the harmony and the creeping dissonance. Though Corinne is taken aback by the male hierarchy and the women who help enforce it, Farmiga doesn't turn them into caricatures. They caricature themselves by being so doctrinaire. When her best friend speaks in tongues, an increasingly alienated Corinne is envious. She stands before the mirror, replaying Robert De Niro's You Talking to Me as Please Talk to Me.
Come on, Holy Spirit. Come on. How I love you, Father God. Oh, Holy Spirit. Thank you, Lord. Come on. Come on, Lord. Come on, Holy Spirit. Just wash down on me, Lord. Just come in thy strength and thy power. Get thee behind me. Come in thine own gentle way. Later.
That scene is the high point of Higher Ground. You see both Farmiga's satiric brilliance and her deeply sympathetic imagination. Corinne tries to explore her feelings before the congregation, which bridles at her preaching. Women aren't supposed to preach, and her questioning spirit. But she doesn't slam the door on the way out, like the self-righteous Nora of Ibsen's A Dollhouse. She wishes she could stick around. And Farmiga and co-screenwriter Briggs depict her life outside the faith as full of its own perils. On the debit side, Farmiga hasn't found the right style for Corinne's surreal visions, which seems silly. And there's a casting glitch. Joshua Leonard plays the older Ethan, and while he's a good actor, he doesn't suggest an ex-teen heartthrob. His whininess makes it too easy for Corinne to fall out of love. Higher Ground would play like an angry, anti-conversion melodrama if there weren't a trace of petulance in Corinne's anger at the Holy Spirit for not speaking to her. It's called faith, after all, because reinforcement can be a long time coming. So the film is complicated, unresolved, in the best kind of way. Farmiga's directing debut is amazingly graceful.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.